There's been another round of layoffs at two Caterpillar sites in Aurora and East Peoria.
Well, obviously, it does ripple back through the community. No one likes to see jobs lost. They like to see jobs move into the area. But people also are understanding in the area that things have to be done to survive.
Today, as we continue our series talking about economic opportunity in Illinois, we focus on manufacturing jobs. We'll hear how the Peoria area is handling Caterpillar's job losses and talk with the Illinois Manufacturers Association about the broader challenges all of its members are facing. Plus, how do we react to stress differently from our primate relatives?
And it's really not until you get to, like, smart social primates that you get animals who are smart enough to invent social and psychological stress for each other that's chronic.
We speak with Stanford scientist and professor Robert Sapolsky about stress, health, and what we can learn from our animal counterparts. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about economic opportunity all this week on the program. Yesterday, we talked about college tuition costs. Today, we're talking about jobs in Illinois with a focus on manufacturing. Tomorrow, we're going to be looking at the coal industry. There are more than 500,000 people in Illinois that are employed in manufacturing. The Bureau of Labor Statistics are showing a consistent 1-2% decline in those jobs compared to last year. We've been seeing that every month in the employment data for Illinois. Like many former manufacturing centers across the Midwest, many of the jobs lost over the past two decades haven't returned. So where are we at now with manufacturing in Illinois? Later in the hour, we're going to be focusing on Caterpillar's most recent layoff announcements in Aurora and East Peoria, hundreds getting layoff notices this month. As always, you're welcome to join our conversation. Those of you listening with your questions and comments, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21st Show. We're starting today with Greg Bays. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. They say they're the largest and oldest American professional manufacturers association with about 4,000 member companies. Greg, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Nice to be here today.
Greg, the last time you and I spoke, it was just after the temporary stopgap budget was resolved in Springfield. And I remember you saying that you were disappointed. On behalf of your members, why is that?
Well, manufacturers, like most business people, crave predictability. They want to know what's going on. And one of Illinois' major problems is that we don't know where the future is headed. We have $10 billion in backlog bills, and we have a pension system that has a $100 billion obligation that is not being funded properly. And business people in general, manufacturers in particular, look at that as a danger sign. And so the state's fiscal house and not being in order is one of our major concerns, but that's not solely the reason that we are experiencing some of the job losses that you were talking about in your introduction.
Right, and sure. Certainly a lot of those have to do with global and national economic issues that I want to get to later. There's a lot of cyclical things within the manufacturing industry, and we can talk about that for a minute. But I wanted to just stay with the Illinois situation for a moment. One thing that I know is when you talk to businesses, one of the most pressing issues they feel like they do not have a handle on in Illinois is workman's comp. Can you explain a little bit why businesses, in particular your members, want to see that issue have a better resolution than it is currently in Illinois?
Workers' comp has always been, and for a long time, as long as I've been in this job, and that's been a while, and about the higher cost of workers' comp in premiums and also for our self-insured companies than other states, in particular even our Midwestern states. Example, medical costs are significantly higher. The medical fee schedule that is operated in the workers' comp arena when an injured worker it goes to the hospital or it has to have rehabilitation or some from an injury in the workplace, medical professionals are charging exorbitant amounts higher than they would if taking care of a normal injury that would occur at your home or not in the workplace. And, for example, a carpal tunnel injury, if it is not related to your work, a surgeon may charge $2,500 for the activity in repairing that workers' comp or that carpal tunnel issue. In workers' comp, that may be as high as $7,000 for that procedure. Also, the other part of the cost of workers' compensation, which is about a $3 billion system in Illinois that it costs businesses each year, is in the indemnity, or what is paid for an injured worker's loss of the use of an arm, for example, possibly the loss of a finger or whatever. And we are significantly higher than most of our Midwestern states around us in that area as well. For example, if you lose the use of your right arm in an injury, you may be paid upwards of $450,000 for that loss. Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, other states like that, the average is about $169,000. There's really no payment that you can get to repair something like that, but that is how the system works. And those higher costs is most often cited by our members as reasons why they do not look to expand in Illinois when looking at other states possibly.
And Greg, as you sort of break down those business costs that companies are looking at, of course, for their bottom line, we put that in the context of what you've already said about the pension situation, about uncertainty or regarding the economy, given the inaction that we've seen in Springfield. How would you describe what you think economic opportunity looks like for Illinois manufacturers?
It's not good. I recently gave a speech to the City Club of Chicago that was entitled Illinois Closing One Day at a Time. And the culprit I put the finger at is government in general, both specifically the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago. Why those institutions? One, the state can't seem to get its act together from a fiscal standpoint. We realize as business people that there may be a need for additional revenues. And in fact, I think it's wrong for the state to have that backlog of $10 billion in bills, vendors that do business with the state waiting upwards of a year to get paid means the state of Illinois is financing its activities on the backs of those businesses. And regulations, the idea that how and they are implemented and how the idea and they go forward with those regulations are something that I think both the city and the state don't really realize the onerous nature of what they do to businesses in this state. So when you talk about manufacturing, which can move and can go to other locations, unlike services like retail and whatever, they look at other states and they just find it more friendly to do business there. And when you talk about job creation, the statistic that's alarming is that since 2009, really with the start of coming out of the 07-08 recession, other states have created a net increase in manufacturing jobs. Michigan, 171,000. The state of Indiana, 83,000. Ohio, 75,000. Illinois, a net increase of manufacturing jobs of 4,900 when I gave the speech, and this month's Bureau of Labor Statistics came out. And actually, we lost 4,400.
Right, when you look at the preliminary August numbers, yeah.
Right. I mean, and so you look at those job losses, but you look at what's going on in other states. There has to be a connection to what's going on here and those lack of job creation.
I understand, Greg, that next week you're going to be in Springfield to be talking about this issue. What do you want lawmakers to know about this?
We think that they should realize, and there should be more outrage over the loss of these jobs, because these jobs are really the backbone of the middle class. And when you have the outcry for, the minimum wage for $15, which creates a $31,000 a year job, the outrage really should be pointed is, why are we not creating manufacturing jobs in this state, which on average are $75,000 as a good paying job? We think the state needs to get its fiscal house in order. We think that permanent workers' comp reform needs to be enacted quickly. We think that the state's tax code needs to be revitalized and looked at. We're willing to support additional revenues for important state and local activities, but you must put in the kind of reforms necessary before we'll be able to support that. We also think the state's property tax system is a real burden on both businesses and certainly homeowners. And finally, we have a real critical workforce shortage in this state. And what I mean by that is we are retiring workers as the baby boomers age, and we're not creating enough skilled workers to be able to take those place of those jobs. And skilled workforce has always been one of Illinois' great strengths, a workforce that can be trained, a workforce that has a business owner has the ability to hire and be able to perform tasks. And in manufacturing, that's very important.
Thanks for taking the time to be with us. Greg Bays is the president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association, 4,000 member companies across Illinois who are doing, and also companies who are doing business within Illinois. Greg, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Good to be with you today.
One of those companies we mentioned, Caterpillar, this week we got word that 20 to 30 workers are going to be let go in East Peoria. That layoffs include techs, engineers, and the plant manager. That's according to WCBU's Tanya Kuntz. We're going to be speaking with her in a few minutes. Caterpillar says in a statement that these workforce reductions are part of, quote, Caterpillar's ongoing restructuring actions. While Caterpillar did confirm the layoffs were taking place that were occurring in East Peoria and Aurora, it would not provide us with a specific number. Earlier this morning, we spoke with the head of the East Peoria Chamber of Commerce, Rick Swan. Hi, Rick. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks, Nyla. Appreciate the opportunity.
I know that companies like Caterpillar tend to be very big employers. When you're talking about layoffs, even if they're in the range of 15 to 20 workers, I wonder what kind of ripple effect you see from layoffs in a community when a manufacturer sometimes is letting people go.
Well, obviously, it does ripple back through the community. It's jobs. No one likes to see jobs lost. They like to see jobs move into the area. But people also are understanding in the area that things need, you know, with the economic conditions, the mining, a lot of the other factors that enter into Caterpillar's business, construction, all of that, that things have to be done to survive. But we've been fortunate in the area that our medical facilities and some of the other community partners here have built businesses, and it continues to grow. So it's being spread. Some of the jobs are in other things now that, rather than manufacturing. So we've been fortunate.
I was going to ask you that, Rick. I mean, for a town like East Peoria, how important is manufacturing? How important is a company like Caterpillar now compared to, say, 15 or 20 years ago?
Oh, it's drastically changed with technology and services, and you know it's just people are doing a lot more with less people because of the technology. But then that's opened up a lot of other fields and services that they're able to provide. So it's, you know, it's not as much manual labor as it used to be because of the computerized environment that most businesses work in today. So it has changed, but you know, it's also created other jobs.
Mm-hmm. So, what kind of businesses, right, for you all with the Chamber of Commerce? What kind of businesses do you see as most important to East Peoria's economy, and what businesses do you think are most needed for the people of East Peoria?
Well, it's diverse. I mean, we work very well with all the surrounding communities, Peoria, Morton, Chillicothe, East or Pekin, all of those communities, Washington. And it's a group effort to bring businesses into the area. You know, we meet regularly. We work with all the major players along with small businesses. So it's a group effort to make this area an attractive area for businesses to move into. And we see a lot of smaller businesses developing, you know, with technical services. We see a lot of hospitality-type businesses, restaurants, that sort of thing. And we've got great educational facilities with Bradley, Mid-States, ICC, the Junior College do a tremendous amount of training. Agencies like Goodwill Industries are looking out there and finding jobs for our veterans, people that are looking to, you know, that maybe have been down on their luck a little bit and look for training now. So it's a big community effort to keep us going as we go down through the rough times. And, you know, in business always runs in cycles. And
I wonder where you think cyclically we are. And I think when you think about East Peoria, the Peoria area, all of those different areas that you mentioned, and I'm thinking about this not necessarily in the context of the international and national economy, which is certainly what affects Caterpillar, but I'm also thinking about Illinois, and I'm thinking about the situation we've been in the past year with the state and some uncertainty around budget funding for the state and for different state universities. I'm also thinking about the business climate and how that maybe affects businesses. I know certainly issues like workers' compensation and those things are really important for businesses. They would like to see those issues be maybe handled a little bit differently in Illinois. Is that what you're hearing from your members?
Exactly. And, you know, we work very closely with our representatives. And, you know, and it's not that I don't think anyone doesn't want the state to progress. I think we just need to get over some hurdles and, you know, and get things done. The budget obviously was, you know, a big factor with funding to schools, nonprofits, all of these organizations that employ folks and train people, those sort of things. Workman comp is a very, very big issue. So, you know, that's one issue that we've gone through. And you know, the state has now gathered the reputation of being unfriendly to business, if you talk to several people. But on the flip side of that, you'll hear the converse. So it's...
What do you think? Better. Do you think that the state is, do you think right now conditions are unfriendly to business?
It seems to be that way. You know, when you talk to people that are looking to locate here, especially the bigger industries, the incentives that some surrounding states are throwing out there, you know, obviously sound very good. But you also have to remember what the cost of that is long term.
That's Rick Swan. He's the executive director of the East Peoria Chamber of Commerce. Rick, thanks for taking the time to be with us.
All right, Nyla. Thank you.
Coming up on the 21st, we're going to continue our conversation about manufacturing jobs. We're going to be focusing on Caterpillar in particular and those jobs that we were just talking about. Tanya Kuntz from WCBU is going to be joining us from our partner station in Peoria, telling us how the community is reacting as we continue our conversation about economic opportunity in Illinois with a focus on manufacturing jobs. You're listening to the 21st. Stay tuned. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. By the way, when we're not on air, you can always catch us online. Search for www.21stshow.org to find links to our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter. If you like us on Facebook, search for the 21st. We've been doing some Facebook Live. We did our first one yesterday evening from the Pygmalion Festival, and we'll be doing that again throughout the weekend. So make sure you like our page. We've been talking about manufacturing jobs in Illinois. Late last week, as we've been talking about another round of layoffs at two Caterpillar sites in Illinois, in Aurora and East Peoria. That follows 300 or so workers getting layoff notices at a Caterpillar facility in Mossville at the beginning of this month. We just heard from the East Peoria Chamber of Commerce, their executive director, Rick Swan, about how those layoffs are having a ripple effect into his community. And we're joined now by Tanya Kuntz. She's the news director at our partner station, WCBU Peoria Public Radio, and joins us from there now. Tanya, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Nyla. Glad to be here.
Tanya, what do we know about this most recent round of layoffs? This is something you've been following pretty closely.
Certainly. Let's talk about which one. I think that's the most important question, because at the beginning of the month, of course, those 300 people at Mossville, those people were actually walked out of the plant in Mossville. And that came in addition to other layoffs. The only reason those 300 layoffs were assigned a number in the beginning of the month layoffs was because it hit something called the Warren Act, mm-hmm. which meant it was a certain percentage of the employees at that facility that the federal government said had to be given like 60 days mm-hmm. Pay and benefits. And then there were other people who were also walked out in support positions and salaried sort of managerial positions. So those would be engineers and techs mostly. So that happened at the beginning of the month. Mm-hmm. That may have been about 500 people. The way that is a moving target, it really is hard to tell completely. Then there were another, say, maybe 20 or so people who were walked out of the East Peoria facility last week. Those were also tech and engineering kind of positions. That apparently included one plant manager without totally disclosing his identity. he apparently, now this comes from people inside the plant, and I'm not attaching any names to my sources, so understand that that's the way I'm working on all of this. That man apparently walked other people off the job, and then somebody came back and walked him out. That was the way that went down.
So it really seems like, and I should make a note to our audience, we're speaking with Tanya Kuntz. She's the news director at WCBU, Peoria Public Radio. She's joining us from there. And we did reach out to Caterpillar, invite them to be a part of this conversation today. They did send us a statement, which we read earlier in the hour. We know that these layoffs are part of an ongoing restructuring that Caterpillar is taking that it announced last year, 10,000 jobs across the world. Caterpillar did confirm that the layoffs were taking place in East Peoria and Aurora. They would not confirm a specific number. Tanya, obviously, with these people, we're talking about job losses. It's very sensitive. People are worried about them losing their job, hence the anonymity. I just want to explain that to our audience.
Sure.
There's a lot of risk involved with people talking about this. That said, Tanya, what's the union's response to all of this? What are we hearing about the different unions that work with these workers? What are they saying about this?
There is a whole lot of concern among the rank and file. So understand that since 2011, this region, the UAW 974, Local 974, had like 7,500 members 5 years ago. And as of today, they sit at a membership of just a little more than 2,000 people. That is so significant to this overall conversation when you're talking about job losses. Someplace between 1,000 and 1,500 of those layoffs and job reductions of the union force have been in the last 2 years in this region. So,
when we think about that, Tanya, we think about the economic impact of that. I want to get to that in a second. I want to talk about some of these jobs, and in particular what we've seen in the past month, engineers. And what's the sense? Are these engineers who are going to leave the area? Because we know that oftentimes as Caterpillar's restructuring, they're offered opportunities within the company, perhaps outside of Illinois. Do we have the sense that these people are just going to pick up and leave?
That is still unclear. That would be the assumption. I anticipate that there will be some houses placed on the market and people relocating because there aren't additional jobs to soak that up here, as near as I can tell. I could be completely wrong about that, but there doesn't seem to be anything that's making the radar now that would replace those 300 jobs at Mossville alone that were reduced at the beginning of the year when it comes to techs and engineers. Beginning of the month.
We're talking about all kinds, right? Because we're talking about engineers, we're talking about factory workers, we're talking about office employees. Uh-huh. How is the community, how are people in the Peoria area community reacting to this?
In many ways, I think people are still fairly numb about the whole thing. This has impacted, if it hasn't impacted people directly, it impacts somebody they know or somebody they love. There isn't anybody in this community who walks around not being affected by this, whether they know somebody or whether it's going to affect them economically as we move down the road. So much of that, Nyla, is yet unseen, I think.
Tanya, I wonder if you can describe for people who are not familiar with the area what Caterpillar's presence had been like when we're talking about Mossville, we're talking about East Peoria. What role do you think, and obviously we know this is kind of a cyclical industry, right? So we've been
sure,
here before.
Sure.
But what are the operations? What have they been looking like the past year or two?
Well, in 2012, the company was really quite strong, right? And so we've seen the international marketplace for Caterpillar specifically has faltered over that time. So yesterday, in a conversation with a union person, it was pointed out to me that maybe the media has failed. Maybe the press has failed this whole situation, because largely much of this may have started in the Peoria region in 2008. 2008 when Caterpillar announced it was moving small business manufacturing to Seguin, Texas. Mm-hmm. And that took overall very quietly, took about 3,000 jobs apparently out of Mossville. There are two buildings apparently in Mossville right now that are fairly much sitting empty. The union anticipates one of those buildings will be torn down by the end of the year. And so the feeling here is it's quiet, but it's one of concern, I think, by most.
Tanya, we have about a minute and a half left, and I just wonder what people for these immediate layoffs, as well as we're thinking about what we've been talking about over the past couple of years, how much are people looking at retraining? What kind of resources are being available for people to maybe, I don't know, switch into other industries or maybe get trained into perhaps more skilled manufacturing jobs if those are also existing in the Peoria area?
Mm-hmm. So I don't know exactly how to address that. When you're talking about engineers and people with computer science degrees, I'm not sure what you talk about retraining for folks like that that
right,
already
those
have
are
a fairly
just,
significant
right,
amount
those
of education.
Just leave,
right,
kind of,
absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the rank and file union member that is being reassigned, I think Rick Swan with the East Peoria Chamber of Commerce talked about the Goodwill job retraining and placement sort of efforts. I know that there are those things going on. I don't have a very good sense of exactly how broad-based those are. I know that Caterpillar also makes every effort to help people find additional employment. Because this is so massive, I don't know how pervasive those services are to rank and file union members.
Thanks for that. Tanya Kuntz, news director at WCBU Peoria Public Radio on Caterpillar and the layoffs that have occurred. Tanya, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We know that being under too much stress can be bad for our overall health, but what can we do about it? Are there lessons that we can take from the animal kingdom about how to be less stressed? We're joined now by Robert Sapolsky. He's a science writer, a biologist, a neuroscientist, a stress expert, and a MacArthur Genius Grant Award winner. He's a professor at Stanford University. He's in Champaign to give a talk this evening at 6:30 p.m. at the Pygmalion Festival. It's on the topic of stress and health, but he's with us now. Robert, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Now, your talk this evening is entitled Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. So it's also the title of a book you wrote that's a guide to stress-related diseases and coping. I think we should start out by asking, maybe let's start with people. What happens on a biological level when a person experiences stress?
Well, the critical question to sort of follow that up with is what kind of stress? And the point is it the kind of stress that would be familiar to our ancestors, to most of the animals running around this planet? Is it, in other words, somebody's very intent on eating you, or if you're going to survive the night, you better be very intent on eating somebody else? If it's normal stress in that sense, everything that goes on in your body in response to it is exactly what you need for that crisis. On the other hand, if you're being a socially intelligent, highly evolved, neurotic primate like we are, and you're being stressed instead, thinking about the upcoming elections or ozone layers or if Social Security will still be there when you're elderly or traffic jams or any of that stuff that's inventions of the human mind, what you're doing there is you turn on the stress response chronically for these purely psychological reasons. And the key point of the whole field is that's not what it evolved for.
But you're saying that essentially as humans, we have the same reaction, a fight or flight, I think is kind of the common term, right?
Yep.
We have the same physiological reaction to, as you're saying, an everyday kind of stress event that we would to, say, like a zebra with a lion chasing after them.
Yep, or where sort of the commonality with real animals out there is where it's a short-term physical crisis. Because what the stress response is mostly about is supplying energy to your muscles, speeding up your heart, and shutting down everything in your body that's unessential. And that's absolutely great if you're running for your life. And it's also great if you're like playing soccer or if you're in some like acutely physically demanding moment, but it makes no sense at all if you're thinking about 30-year mortgages. And the key point is exactly what you said. When you are being stressed and like increasing your blood pressure, that's your body attempting to make your thigh muscles work more effectively to run away from a leopard. And if instead you're doing that because of your boss or because of some sort of psychological turmoil and you're doing it chronically, that's just like the antithesis of what you should be doing with your body.
Right. So do you think that so when a zebra is being chased by a lion and it's over and they're not dead, do they just kind of forget about it and they kind of go on with their lives?
As far as I can tell, and as part of my work, I've spent 30 years working intermittently in the Serengeti in East Africa. So I've seen a lot of zebras have near misses. And I suspect 30 seconds later, you're absolutely right, they haven't a clue what's going on. And all they're thinking about is it this blade of grass or that one that I want to get at this point? They're simply not smart enough to be chronically psychologically turmoiled
as we've evolved to be
we are experts at. And it's really not until you get to like smart social primates that you get animals who are smart enough to invent social and psychological stress for each other that's chronic.
And do you think that's what we do? Do you think humans have evolved to invent social and psychological stress that we inflict upon each other?
Absolutely. And I think one of the best measures of it is like looking at, you know, a huge percentage of other primates are hierarchical. They have rank systems and like all things considered, if you're going to be a baboon, you don't want to be a low ranking one. I mean, your life really is not great if you're a subordinate non-human primate. But what we've done as humans is invent a way of subordinating low-ranking primates like nothing the animal world has ever seen. We invented socioeconomic status. And it turns out poverty has a huge amount to do with a body that's having an overactive chronic stress response and all sorts of health implications of that. So yeah, we take the gold medal among primates in terms of ways of just being corrosively subordinating to our have-nots, and our bodies reflect that.
So I have a quick question for you about primates and about baboons. Do you think that they have invented this because they simply have a lot more time on their hands because they're not running for their lives, or?
Basically, and it's actually baboons that I studied over the years out there. And if you're a baboon, the greatest place to live on Earth is the Serengeti. It's this enormous plain, you know, like you live in these big social groups so that predators really don't mess with you too much. Your infant mortality rate is relatively low. And the key thing is that you only have to spend about 3 hours a day foraging for your day's calories. And what that means is, like, one of the most important implications in the entire world of primate interactions, what that means is you've got 9 hours of free time every single day to devote to making somebody else miserable if you don't like them. All they do all day long is play, like, baboon chess with each other of just Machiavellian stuff, and whatever it is always rolls downward and the low ranking get the grief from it. They live well enough and long enough that they could devote their time to being psychologically stressful to each other. They're just like us. They're wonderful models for westernized lives.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Robert Sapolsky about humans and baboons and stress. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're speaking with Robert Sapolsky. He's a science writer, a biologist, a neuroscientist. He's speaking this evening. He's based at Stanford University. He's in Champaign in Illinois to give a talk at the Pygmalion Festival. Robert, you have the best bio I think I've ever read, because it says, like, as a boy in New York City, Robert Sapolsky dreamed of living inside the African dioramas in the Museum of Natural History. By the age of 21, he made it to Africa and joined a troop of baboons. Okay, I'm just going to stop right there, because that's where I feel like that's my favorite line there about. But as you're, you know, we were just talking about how baboons have sort of developed, just like we have, these really intricate social hierarchies. They have time that they spend where they, you know, where they're sort of inflicting all of this stress on each other. When I wonder, you've said that since you studied primates for so long, it makes you look at humans in different ways. How so?
Well, for one thing, you become very conscious of whether other guys have bigger canines than you have, but I suspect that is just a little anxiety on my part there. you also spend a huge amount of time looking at people's rear ends, calculating how much anesthetic you would need in the blowgun dart to take them down.
Is that something that you had to do often?
with baboons, I've rarely had the opportunity to do it with humans, although in faculty meetings that's often occurred to me. I mean, what you do when you look at primates long enough and look at humans is, you know, big surprise. You're struck with both the similarities and the differences. The similarities, we've got the same wiring. We have a crummy, abusive boss, and we're doing the exact same thing with our adrenal glands and the same thing to our immune systems and stomach walls as does a socially subordinate baboon. A female baboon has her infant die, and her stress hormone levels are elevated for a month afterward unless she has close relatives to groom with. Wow, they're so similar.
Yeah.
Emotional similarities. But then you look at the fact that, well, yes, a baboon female will grieve when her infant dies and does the same stuff physiologically that we do, but we can do the same thing thinking about kids in refugee camps on the other side of the planet, or thinking about a fictional character in a book we're reading and are very engrossed with. What we do is we take the exact same, like, off-the-rack physiology as other primates when it comes to emotions and stuff, and we're able to just abstract it in time and space in ways that, like, no other primate can. In absolutely, a baboon sitting there who's low ranking and looking across a field, and his worst rival who terrifies him has just shown up, and simply by thinking, his heart rate's going to increase. We can lie there in bed at night and think, you know, one day, inevitably, no matter what you do, that heart's going to stop beating, and we accelerate our heart rate for that purpose. There's no other animal on earth who could sit there and think about mortality and change the way their body works in response. So in some ways, we're just like every other primate out there in terms of the basic wiring, and then we use it in ways that are just nutty and unprecedented.
And when we think about that, I think there's good things about that, right? The unprecedented part is the empathy that you're talking about, that we can
Absolutely.
Have empathy for other people. We can have empathy for people outside of our social circles. We can have empathy for people across the world. But then sort of the part about it, I imagine that we need to sort of adapt to evolution from an evolutionary perspective, is this how we respond to stress. And I wonder how you think...
Yeah.
How do you think we can do that better, right? Because we've been able to evolve to a point where we can create empathy for other people, but then why do you think it is that we still hang on to, or we have such a interesting connection between our physiological stress responses for things that we really shouldn't be getting stressed out about?
Well, it's, again, sort of a version of the baboon punchline. We live well enough and long enough to pay the price of what you do when you're chronically activating a stress response. I mean, you run for your life from a lion and your blood pressure is incredibly elevated. That's not a bad thing. That's saving your life. You do the same thing for psychological reasons half of each day for your whole lifetime, and you're going to get cardiovascular disease. The same logic, every single thing you're doing with your body in response to a short-term physical stressor help save your life. And if instead you're doing it day after day, there's just endless diseases by now that we know are exacerbated by stress down to the molecular level. We know the workings of it. So the question becomes, what buffers us from stress? And an enormous literature in psychology shows that basically for the same external reality that's kind of miserable, you're more subjectively stressed and you're more likely to turn on a stress response and you're more at risk for stress-related disease if you feel like you have no control over the circumstances.
Do you think that's what it comes down to?
Well, that and an array of psychological factors. If you feel like you have no predictability as to when it's coming, how bad it's going to be, how long it's going to last, if you don't have any outlets for the frustration caused by the stressor, and probably most importantly, if you don't have the social support. These are enormously powerful variables with a gigantic asterisk at that point, as long as we're talking about the miseries that plague sort of middle-class neurotic humans. No degree of, just psychologically reframe your experience is going to help you if you're homeless or a refugee or have a terminal disease or something, but within the range of sort of the everyday neurotic stressors that are the things that do most of us in, they're enormously sensitive to psychological variables. A sense of control, a sense of predictability, a sense of support that no matter how bad it is, you have somebody's shoulder to lean on at the end of the day. These are enormously protective, and even in ways that impress like card-carrying scientists in lab coats and stuff, because we know the sort of hardcore biology of how this works.
I'm speaking with Robert Sapolsky, and Robert, as I think about this and as I hear what you're saying, sort of healthy ways people can react to stress, I can't help but think about bringing it back to baboons. And I wonder, did you encounter baboons in all of your time that you spent in the Serengeti who you felt like were really good at coping with stress? Like, are there lessons we can, and what do they do?
Well,
did they have good social networks? Were they just kind of relaxed baboons? Like, I don't.
Yeah, that's exactly it. When I was sort of a callow, superficial 20-year-old going out there and starting the research, if you had asked me sort of what's the best predictor of sort of health among these baboons, I would have said it's being high ranking in sort of a stable, entrenched position. And it's taken me kind of growing up to instead realize that far more important is these social and psychological factors. If you have a choice between being a high-ranking baboon or a baboon who can tell the difference between a truly threatening interaction and one that's neutral, can get some control over those interactions, can tell the difference between a good or bad outcome, and if it is a bad outcome, has social support, somebody to go groom with, your health is going to be much better than the highest ranking alpha male on the block if he's a psychological type A who sees threat everywhere.
Well, go ahead.
No, it's just clear psychological variables, even for these animals, are more powerful than the reality of whether you get to eat gazelle earlier than anybody else in the troop.
And I think zebras would kind of think it's totally weird, the things that humans get stressed about. I wonder what else you think animals would find strange about human behavior.
Well, probably clothes. Probably large percentage of our activities. And sort of over the years, it's clear it's the same population of baboons I've gone back to year after year over these decades. And it's clear I'm not a fly on the wall. They know I'm not a baboon, but there's something vaguely baboonish about me. Every few years, someone, usually some like peripheral poor schnook of a male who has like nobody else to interact with, will like make some facial gesture at me suggesting that like I
can I be your friend?
Vaguely familiar. Yeah, or more often there's a a gesture baboons give if somebody is about to pound on them and they're trying to get some coalitional support. So occasionally you get this like squirrely low-ranking kid who's about to be pounded by some high-ranking guys in a bad mood. And he'll try everybody in the troop, and of course nobody like wants to get involved and help him out. And like as a last-ditch attempt, he'll try it with me, like picked last for the baseball team again. Like, can you help at least?
What do you do? Avoid eye contact?
Well, I mean, obviously hoping I'll like run over the other guy with my Jeep or something. But yeah, at those times, sort of scientific objectivity makes me have to pretend I didn't hear him. But, and it's like I'm some kind of like last ditch attempt low ranking primate that sort of registers with them. But
I
am most certainly not a fly on the wall there.
And when, how does that work when all of those years of the decades that you've spent there studying, as you said, they're used to you? Were you always in a Jeep or in some other, are you always sort of very clearly removed from them in a way that it's their? Are you always living apart?
Depends. If it's safe terrain, I would get out of my vehicle with them. And what I'm also doing with some regularity is darting them and anesthetizing key individuals where I then hold on to them for a day and basically do a clinical workup on them to see how's their cholesterol levels, how's their immune system, what's their blood pressure like, how riddled is their gut with various sort of microorganisms. I'm present, but this is at most at 3 months of the year, so then I'm gone for 9 months, mm-hmm. and then suddenly I reappear, and it's sort of that that season again with whoever this primate is who sort of sticks around with us.
Right. I wanted to just sort of circle back to where we started talking about stress, because we've been talking about our body, how our bodies evolved to have a stress response and this sort of fight or flight, which I imagine is probably what the baboons should be doing when they see you pointing a dart gun at them. But when we have that reaction, if we're mad about like a printer that's not working, or people, when we have that same reaction when we're angry at someone who cuts us off in traffic, what tips do you have for people who might want to experience less stress in their daily life?
Well, I sound pretty fatuous at this point because I'm personally horrible at dealing with stress.
Okay.
But
because you just want to shoot everybody with a tranquilizer dart gun.
Exactly, yes. And I've managed to like lecture about this all these years without paying any attention to what I'm saying. But it's clear to the extent that it's our world of typical stressors, outlets in which you are not giving the people around you ulcers in order to avoid getting one yourself, social support, where it's actual real social support as opposed to like the mere acquaintances that most of us sort of confuse with like close friends, a sense of control, as long as you're not trying to feel in control of things that are uncontrollable, so it'll be your fault afterward if you didn't prevent it. All of those have just enormous protective powers, but they don't come easy. And they take a lot of work to stop yourself and try to reframe and reappraise the situation. And, you know, in lots of ways, it comes down to sort of advice our grandmothers gave us about like keeping things in perspective. But insofar as these are all stressors we've invented as a psychologically smart species, absolutely what they are about is a failure of perspective.
Robert Sapolsky is at Stanford University. He's a biologist, a neuroscientist. He's in Champaign this evening. He's going to be speaking at 6:30 tonight at the Pygmalion Festival at Craner Art Center. We'll tweet out all the details to that if you want more information on that. Robert, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, we're going to be continuing our conversations on economic opportunity in Illinois with a look at coal industry jobs. We'll also be talking to the indie band Poster Children. They're back together for the first time in a few years to perform at this weekend's Pygmalion Festival. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app if you search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links and every other way to contact us if you want to give us feedback via phone, email, follow us on social media, it's all at our website, www.21stshow.org. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.